You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Together we can make America great. We can support the president. Don't let anybody in the press think that because he supported my opponent that I do not support him.
Alabama's new senator, Roy Moore, very much not President Trump's choice, though he makes the man who was look a model of moderate liberalism. Is the Republican Party civil war about to get even weirder? My guests John Everard and Terry Stiassny will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including whether we should be panicking about North Korea if South Koreans are not, how big a round of applause Saudi Arabia is due for deciding to repress women slightly less, and would a dead cow hanging from the ceiling put you off your pizza? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, among other postings, and Terry Stiassny, the journalist and author. Welcome both. And we start in Alabama, where voters have ignored the urgings of US President Donald Trump and declined to endorse placeholder Senator Luther Strange as the full-time replacement for Jeff Sessions, who vacated the seat to become Attorney General. Mr. Strange lost the Republican primary to Roy Moore, an old-school brimstone hurler who appears to believe that the Old Testament is a work of dangerously liberal subterfuge. It is a great loss to aficionados of weird American political names. Luther Strange would have sat nicely in the pantheon alongside the likes of Butch Otter, Zach Wamp, Dick Sweat, and Young Boozer. But is it a loss to Donald Trump? Terry, first of all, Donald Trump has been today furiously deleting all his pro-Strange tweets and cheering on Roy Moore. He has always been at war with East Asia and so on. Should Donald Trump be taking this personally? I mean, he will anyway, but
well, I think, as you say, I think, you know, he is very likely to take this personally, and all the reports coming from sort of insiders in the States suggesting that when this result came through, Trump was, you know, very angry, felt that he had been misled, felt that he'd been invited to back the wrong guy. I mean, it's just quite interesting that he was persuaded by the Republicans that he should back, you know, the prospective Senator Strange, who, as you say, is like, does sound like someone Tom Wolfe, you know.
I think we should make the most of uttering the phrase Senator Strange while
Senator
we can.
Luther Strange.
I'm going to miss saying it.
But, I mean, it's surprising because Roy Moore was someone who was, you know, after all, supported by some of the people who'd advised Trump in the past and who, of course, he's now kind of fallen out with, people like Steve Bannon, people like Sebastian Gorka and so on. But I think Roy Moore is the one who sounds, he doesn't have the fictional character name, but he has some of the fictional character beliefs, if you like. This was a man who had the Ten Commandments put in the Alabama Supreme Court building on 5,000 pound stone tablets until this was struck down and he was told this was unconstitutional and you weren't allowed to have the Ten Commandments in your Supreme Court, in your government building. So it's interesting that Trump was sort of pushed to back the other horse in this race, if you like. And it will be interesting to see, obviously, you know, he still technically got to win an election to against the other guy, but, you know, given that Alabama is 62% voted for Trump in the last election, it pretty much just seems like a foregone conclusion.
He has to win an election against a Democrat.
Yeah.
And if you can find a bookmaker who will take the bet,
I
would pile in big. John, as Terry suggests, Senator presumptive Roy Moore is a bit of a live one, twice suspended from his previous job as Chief Justice of the great state of Alabama for, you know, not obeying the law. What can we actually glean from this? Is it, and this sounds like, I mean, I've asked a lot of questions over the last couple of years I thought I would never ask, but here's another one. Is the Republican Party actually about to get even crazier?
I'm gagging at that prospect. But yes, what can we glean from this? I think this is fascinating. Remember, when Trump came to power, he was the insurgent, the man voted in by millions of Americans to wreck the deep state, hand power back to the people, and, you know, essentially at the stroke of a pen, solve all of America's problems.
These are all still very much a work in progress.
That's right, yes. There's a few sort of outstanding issues still there, as we've said in other editions of Midori House. All of a sudden, he is no longer the insurgent. He is the establishment. And we have a new insurgency within the previous insurgency, Roy Moore overthrowing Luther Strange. That the voters of Alabama, at least the Republican voters, have gone for somebody who is promising a quite different style of government from that offered by a more traditional senator, and somebody who is not Donald Trump. I think that what we are seeing is the Trump version of the collapse of support that George W. Bush suffered at almost exactly the same point in his presidency, 6 months in. Remember when he was inaugurated, all these guys in 10-gallon hats pitching up on the White House lawn and saying, hey, this is the new America. And that support kind of evaporated at the six-month point. In Trump's case, of course, it takes a different form. It would, wouldn't it? But I suspect that we are going to see this pattern repeated in other primaries. This is Alabama. We've got Nevada coming up, and we've got a couple of others. Bob Corker, of course, who would have been a sitting duck for just this kind of insurgency, retired on Tuesday, so his seat up for grabs now. It's looking interesting.
It's only just occurring to me, Terry, that instead of saying that will the Republicans get even crazier, I should have said more strange. It wasn't worth it, really, was it? But is it possible that, as well as what John suggests there, that what we're seeing here is the beginning of a backlash from Trump voters realizing that all the things he said he was going to do, he's not going to do, either because he's not capable of doing them or because they couldn't be done anyway or because he just doesn't really care?
I think it very much is going to depend, you know, state by state and region by region. Because if you've got, you know, the Republican voters of Alabama have obviously, you know, they've gone for Roy Moore. They've gone for the person who is very much, you know, been anti-same-sex marriage, has been, you know, calling homosexuality abhorrent and detestable, a crime against nature. All those kind of, you know, extremely, you know, religiously conservative views. Other places where the battle might be tighter, say, between Republicans and Democrats, that's not necessarily, the maverick candidate is not necessarily going to be the one that even Republican voters are going to vote for. And it might be that when you look at other contests as they come up and as they're filling other gaps, that, you know, the more sort of centrist, if that's the right word, the more mainstream candidate might be the viable option. So, you know, the Republican Party establishment might actually have been right in more other cases, and in Alabama may be something of an outlier in this one. We don't necessarily know.
John, is there, I guess, a conforming to a well-worn historical dynamic perhaps occurring here? Revolutions / insurgencies do have a habit of consuming those who launch them.
Yes, they do, as we've seen in so many cases. Are they going to on this occasion? And in any case, who launched them? I don't get the sense that this is orchestrated from anywhere. This is a groundswell. It's a dangerous ground for Donald Swamp. Donald Swamp. Now, there's a lateral number. For Donald Trump. And I suspect that if you start to consume those who launched it, you're going to have an awful lot of dead bodies around.
Terry, just finally on this, as we reflect on this week in Trumpville or Trumpton or whatever we're calling it, how did his sort of weekend-long policy of picking a fight with the entirety of professional sports work out for him?
Well, he obviously... he seemed... It's hard to say without being there. It's one of those ones that's hard to know. You know, it took me a while to understand exactly what everybody was getting so up in arms about in sort of either way. But obviously, I think this is probably one where Trump may know his sort of viewers and his voters better, if you like. There may be quite a lot of people who think that you should stand for the national anthem rather than the kneel, because to me it took me a while to understand why is kneeling seen as something that's not respectful, because to me it looks, you know, absolutely the ultimate respectful kind of gesture that you would do. But I think that, again, it's sports and the flag and the anthem are something that goes so deep, and I think maybe we're probably not hearing the voices of many of the Trump voters who might think that he's taken the right view on it. Not that I would say I would agree with that. I don't at all. But I can kind of see why he would pick that fight.
Well, let's move along now. In amidst the recent excitable, gusting, hysterical coverage of North Korea and the threat posed by its missile arsenal and nuclear programs, one story we haven't read much of is widespread panic, looting, sandbagging basements and fleeing for the hills in South Korea, which is, of course, because there hasn't been any. The question prompted is, are the South Koreans better attuned to the caprices of their fulminating neighbour, or have they just become complacent? John, you've spent a lot of time in both Koreas. The South Koreans are obviously aware of global coverage of North Korea, which is... does tend to, not without a certain amount of assistance from the North Korean regime, conform to a template of this sort of strange cartoonish Bond villain, you know, bellyaching angrily at the world about who knows what. Do South Koreans see the coverage as just as weird as they see, as just as weird as North Korea?
Yes, basically they do. I think there's a... If when you talk to most South Koreans about North Korea, you get a kind of, you know, the horrible fascination of the place, but you also get a lot of numbness. A lot of the problem is the South Koreans have lived with this very, very close. Remember, you know, you only got 3/4 hour drive from Seoul before you hit the DMZ. They've lived with this for so many years that they've just become inured, you know, that their normal panic reactions have been deactivated. This time round, we're not seeing panic, as you rightly point out. We are seeing quite a lot of precautionary buying of emergency kits. These are on sale in big department stores, and they contain useful things like candles and blankets and medical kits, the kind of things that you might need if you find that normal services are suddenly and violently withdrawn. But it is simply not in the South Korean character anymore to get in a flap about this. I was there during the great crisis of August 2016, when we were probably not quite as close to war as we are now, but it looked pretty bad. And South Korean friends kept coming up to me and saying, if there's going to be a war, please tell me and I'll start driving. Until then, life goes on. And I think we'll see the same this time around.
Terry, do you find it at all reassuring, the South Korean sort of stoicism about this? Because I do, and this is whenever I I get as tempted as anybody else to get caught up in the World War III to begin tomorrow variety headlines. But then if you actually read South Korean media and look at what South Korean people are saying online, there does tend to be a general atmosphere of
I do find it reassuring.
Listeners couldn't see the gesture I was making there, but it was a world-weary shrug I was going for.
I mean, as John says, if you live so close to something for such a long time, you do get used to it. And I don't know South Korea myself, but I'm put in mind of, you know, Central Europe and Austrians, for instance, during the Cold War, who also were sort of, you know, half an hour's drive from a great big, you know, barbed wire fence.
Indeed.
And they just, you know, they'd had Russian soldiers around. They dealt with it with a kind of a black humour and, well, whatever happens. And yes, you might have your bag full of emergency kit, but, you know, there's not really an awful lot you can do about it if there is going to be a war that's fought over your head. So I can see why you would just think, yeah, panicking is not particularly going to help at this point.
Absolutely. And even Brits in the Cold War, I mean, I'm old enough to remember, we were told all the time that our lives might be ended very suddenly, very quickly by a nuclear attack. From time to time, we had to do drills. We were all told where our nearest nuclear shelter was and who was going to be responsible. It was all very real. But after you'd done a few of these, again, you just went numb. And I remember sort of lying in bed one Sunday morning with my girlfriend at the time, turning to her and saying, what happens if we get hit by a nuclear bomb? And she sat up on her elbow, looked at me and said, we die, and went back to sleep again, which seems to be about the right reaction.
On the subject of drills, John, is there much general preparation made by South Korean authorities? Are there signals that everybody knows to listen for? Are there things people know they're supposed to do if it all goes terribly wrong?
Yes, there are. They're well drilled. People know what they're supposed to do, and they know who's going to be in charge. Also, as you go about your daily business in Seoul, if you use the Seoul metro, there are big glass cases there of emergency kits in case you happen to be in the metro system at the time that war breaks out on the surface. You know, things like gas masks to protect you, blankets, all kinds of useful things. So there's a constant daily reminder that this is real. People would know what to do, but as I say, you know, they've worried about this for so long that they've worn themselves out.
Terry, it's a question I've asked John before now, which I'll ask you now as well, and it's an extension of what you see the South Koreans doing, just sort of going about their business, not responding to provocations. From a global perspective, what would happen, do we think, if the next time North Korea did something like tested a nuclear weapon, launched a missile, threatened to turn the South China Sea into a lake of fire, or whatever the present correct language is, if the world just ignored them? I'm not going to try and do my world-weary shrug gesture again, but if the world just went, whatever.
I think probably calming down, you know, certainly it would help if somebody took Donald Trump's phone away from him whenever this happened, and that we didn't get a sort of, you know, rocket man bit of rhetoric or something that just, you know, just riles people up even more and doesn't particularly help. I think probably, you know, quiet interventions from John's current counterparts are probably much more effective in, you know, actually trying to sort this out than responding with a panic, you know, we're all going to die. I think, you know, probably this is a place where, you know, good old-fashioned diplomacy is a lot more effective.
Andrew, we know the answer to that question. It was the long doctrine of the Obama administration. It's called strategic patience. You do not react to provocations. You do not get excited. The result has been that they are very close to having a nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missile. Not a good result.
So if that didn't work, if ignoring him doesn't work, does that mean is it therefore wrong, do you think, to just think of the regime as you would think of a work-a-day attention seeker?
There's more than work-a-day attention seeking going on. They are ploughing ahead with a very carefully articulated and very well-planned program, which, if it's not stopped, means that they will be in a position to obliterate American cities, and they will use that leverage to secure all kinds of international goodies. If it came to it, they would press the button.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break, potentially a long one, really, if we use this opportunity as a head start to flee for our bunkers in the hills. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with John Everard and Terry Stiassny. Coming up next, Saudi Arabia takes a bold leap into the early 20th century.
Visit our online shop, where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around.
They've reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's week that was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits of all our magazine shows, from The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneurs, Culture to Section D, premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or on SoundCloud to ensure that you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are John Everard and Terry Stiassny. Now, of all the nonsenses imposed upon women by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it is the one that has become the most infamous and emblematic, the ban on women driving cars. Possibly because of the notoriety of this particular decree, King Salman has rescinded it and declared that henceforth the open road will be free to Saudi women. They're still not allowed to dress how they like or open a bank account without male permission. However, we don't want to go crazy. Where would it end? Terry, how big a round of applause is King Salman due here?
I think, you know, sort of a good cheer and a half, I would say. I mean, you know, there have been so many campaigns, women actually going out and driving who were banned for it, who were arrested, who were stopped. And just to see the happiness in some of the reports from some of the women. There was a woman called Sahar Nassif who just said, I'm going to go out and buy myself a convertible Mustang and drive it around. And women saying things like, the rain begins with a single drop. So, you know, this is a start of something. I mean, yes, of course, as you say, they have still got a hell of a long way to go, you know, literally, metaphorically. You know, this women still, as you say, have to ask men for permission to have a passport, permission to travel, permission to marry, open a bank account. But I just think giving women more the freedom to, you know, the freedom to drive gives you more freedoms eventually. It gives you the freedom to decide where you're going to go, who you're going to go there with, possibly opens up possibilities of more jobs and so on. So I think anything that encourages that, I think these things can have, you know, unforeseen consequences, and I hope that they're good ones for Saudi women.
John, it is a good thing in and of itself, but is it being untowardly cynical to suspect that from here on, every time somebody has a pop at the Saudis about women's rights and Lord knows there's the material, they're going to reply, but we've let them drive cars. What's your problem?
Yes, I'm sure that is going to be the reply. But I think there's room for hope that this is the beginning of a major change. Remember, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the Crown Prince, has laid out his vision of Saudi 2030, which embraces all kinds of social change. And he seems to have persuaded, very importantly, the guardians of the faith to agree to this. This was a crucial point. This was not just signed off by the king. It was signed off by the king after exhaustive discussions with the religious authorities. Now, in a curious kind of way, this was an easy victory because Islamic scholars have argued for a long time over whether there was actually any scriptural justification for banning women from driving. And a lot of scholars had said that, you know, it was wrong, that never mind, you know, what women wanted. You shouldn't do this in any case. It was un-Islamic. It's going to be a bit more difficult with some other things that women have quite rightly been asking for and other broader changes in Saudi society. But it is a very good thing. In the immortal words of Yogi Bear, yabba dabba doo.
Terry, if we're going to try being slightly generous to King Salman, which is not something I'm overly keen to do, but nonetheless, let's go with it. Is it possible that he's floating this one to try and figure out what his subjects are actually willing to tolerate, where the limits are? Because it is the reality that whatever reformist tendencies any Saudi ruler may have, they are in their way at the mercy of what is still an extremely conservative country.
Yes, I think that's, you know, that's bound to be the case. You know, they're bound to want to gauge the extent of the backlash. And looking at some of the reports today, they were suggesting that although you saw a lot of women, you know, or those who have access to internet and social media saying, hooray for this, and I'm going to get my car and I'm going out and drive, there were also, you know, men going on social media saying, you know, the women in my household will not be allowed to drive. And, yeah. Well, you know, they can say that it's going to be a lot harder. They may well try and lay down their own domestic law, but if the law of the land is not backing them up, then it gives the women obviously much more ammunition to do what they want. But yes, I can see that, you know, if suddenly there is a massive conservative backlash against this, then the next reforms or more freedoms for women may be harder to get hold of. But, you know, if even the slightest bit of empowerment for women is going to take on a momentum of its own.
It is depressingly easy to imagine the prospect of vigilante attacks against women who are bold enough to be among the first to take to the roads as licensed drivers.
I hope not. Yes, I mean, one of the other interesting facts that struck me is apparently there are 800,000 chauffeurs employed in Saudi Arabia, most of whom are people who've come in from outside. And you can imagine if you're an immigrant to Saudi who's come in to do this job and that job is under threat, that may cause a whole set of different problems if you don't then suddenly decide to go and, you know, retrain as a driving instructor or whichever, you know, move into some other line of work. So there may be other unforeseen consequences further down the line.
John, what do you think? Is this possibly, slash hopefully, a thin end of the wedge?
I hope it is. I think it's too early to say. MBS has said effectively that it is, but I suspect that certain religious conservatives will think otherwise. I think we just have to see what happens when he tries the next reform.
Terry, as I sort of suggested when I introduced this, it's always hard to know how to react to something like this. It reminds me a bit of, you know, somebody who goes on daytime television and announces that they're going to stop taking drugs and committing crimes and expects a round of applause. Whereas, of course, they could have just not done that to start with. In reacting to this development in Saudi Arabia, what is the smart move by the West? Is it a kind of slightly, you know, a slow hand clap and by all means keep up the good work, or are we still overindulging Saudi Arabia?
Ooh, I think the areas in which we are arguably overindulging Saudi Arabia are the bigger sort of you know, geopolitical ones. In there, there's much bigger issues which are sort of separate from this, if you like, in terms of, you know, what weaponry do we sell them? How do we treat Saudi Arabia's behaviour on the international stage? Yeah, I think we should be giving this a cautious welcome and saying that's great. Yeah, you know, now for the next steps. And I think we should, you know, if you're going to say that we're a country that supports equal rights for women, yes, you should be trying to encourage them wherever there is, you know, progress towards it.
Is there any analogy or any overlap here, I guess, John, between Saudi Arabia and North Korea, both slightly cloistered, closed countries which have proved remarkably reluctant to many forms of diplomatic leverage? Is there anything we learn from one that can be applied to the other?
There are parallels, but actually transferring lessons from one to the other is a bit difficult. North Korea is socially, of course, much more liberal than Saudi Arabia in many ways.
Women, so are most places, in fairness.
Well, yes, it's not an exacting standard. I do take your point. I mean, women can not only drive, they can even ride bicycles, which I don't think they'll be doing in Saudi Arabia for some time to come.
There would be, I guess, technical as well as legal impediments to that. Finally tonight, though, we should look towards Adelaide. The field of restaurant ceiling decoration has traditionally been a somewhat limited one, largely confined to chandeliers and other even less ambitious light fittings. An Adelaide pizzeria called Etika has branched audaciously out, suspending from its rafters an entire stuffed cow, specifically a Frisian Hereford cross. The proprietors claim to be highlighting, as they put it, the realities of the dairy industry. Terry, if you walked into a restaurant, however pleasant and well-reviewed it had been, and I'm sure Etika's very good, the food in Adelaide generally is, would a stuffed cow hanging from the ceiling put you off?
No, I have walked into a restaurant where there's been a stuffed cow hanging from the ceiling. There is one in Shoreditch.
Get out of town, really?
There is one, the Tram Shed in Shoreditch, which is a Mark Hicks restaurant. It has a Damien Hirst, a cow and a chicken in a big tank. You remember the Damien Hirst with the whole, you know, the whole cow? So, and that's a feature. You know, it must have cost them an absolute fortune because it's an original great big Damien Hirst, which is sort of suspended halfway up. And because it's a steak and chicken restaurant, you know, most of the customers don't seem to mind and see it as an added attraction. And, you know, sort of it makes it for a trendy, arty restaurant in Shoreditch with the original Damien Hirst. So, you know, I'm kind of surprised that there's a fuss about this. But, you know.
So, John, the proprietors of Etika claim that this is not a publicity stunt undertaken in the hope that it will get them discussed in forums such as this. They claim that they think of it as a consciousness-raising exercise. They want people to think about the realities of dairy farming, which I will confess that's not something I often do while dining in restaurants. Is this a useful intervention in the public discourse, if that is their motivation?
If that is their motivation, yes, it is. I think if you eat meat, if you consume dairy products, you ought to be able to live with the reality of how those products end up on your plate or, you know, in your coffee cup or whatever. And a lot of the realities, of course, are less than pleasant. Being reminded by having a large cow swinging over your head as you consume your beef is probably no bad thing. But we're clearly in a minority here. I checked the score of the poll that's been conducted on this just before we went on air. So far, 55% say that this is wrong and shall be removed.
There are a lot of angry people on social media being angry on social media about this, but it is, I don't know, it does highlight, I guess, a certain squeamish hypocrisy from which I don't excuse myself. I am a meat eater, but I can remember working on a story a couple of times in Kabul, and I don't know if the street is still there, but there was one street where all the butchers were, and they literally were doing their butchery on the footpath in the middle of the day. It did turn me kind of vegetarian for a week or so. At least for the duration of my stay.
Yeah, I can see that you would be upset about it if you were, you know, say, a vegan. And, you know, if you went in expecting, you know, vegan pizza with sort of non-dairy cheese or whatever on the top and you had a cow hanging from the ceiling, you might, you know, take your business elsewhere. But apparently the meat from the cow was actually used before they stuffed it. So this was a cow that had been chopped up, eaten, and then somehow very clever taxidermy put back together again. So
And also vegans have been campaigning very hard, at least in this country, for people to be made aware of the real cost in terms of animal suffering of dairy products. I'd thought they'd applaud.
Well, indeed so. That does bring us to the end of today's show. John Everard and Terry Stiastny, thanks both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Mariana Lagrasta and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next, then The Entrepreneurs at 1900, followed by The Cinema Show at 2000. I'm back with The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.